Hi, folks. It's August 7th, 2012. I'm on vacation, but enjoy this show. We've put it together from archive material, and we've got some new interviews this week. I don't know if it's going to happen today or tomorrow or the next day, but you'll find out.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
Hi, folks, it's Sam Cedar, me, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. I'm on vacation. We've pieced together a show for you. Maybe some archive stuff, maybe some new stuff, but enjoy. And here it is. On the phone, we have Rosie Gray from BuzzFeed. Talk about her story inside the Tea Party factory. Welcome to the program, Rosie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Rosie, did you go down to this? You're reporting on a. It starts off with a. I don't know what you call it. A seminar, I guess, of some sorts down at in Dallas in the last week of July. Did you head down there for that?
Yeah, I was in Dallas for FreedomWorks, which is a conservative nonprofit that's sort of seen itself grow a lot since the rise of the Tea Party. They had a big convention in Dallas with Glenn Beck and a bunch of Tea Party senators. So that was last week.
And so tell us what you said. I mean, you mentioned it's 18,500 seat stadium. How was it full?
The organizers estimated that there were about 14,000 or 15,000 people there. That looks about right to me.
And did you get a sense of where folks were coming from?
Yeah, I mean, people were coming. I would say, mostly from Texas, of course, because it was in Texas, but from all around the country, including the East Coast. And also, I met one guy from Canada.
Wow. Okay. And aside from showing the trailer for Atlas Shrugged Part 2, either or, I guess, is the subtitle of the film. What else did they do? Well, let's start. How did the trailer look?
I mean, I don't know if those movies are supposed to be that good. It looked okay. I don't know. I probably wouldn't actually go see it.
Yes. All right. Well, so what else? What else did you see that they were doing there?
Well, they started off with one of their big things is training activists, and so they started off with an hour and a half of. Giving the crowd talks about putting up yard signs and get out the vote techniques and stuff like that. So the first hour and a half was training, and then they basically had a rally, and they had Jim DeMint, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, a bunch of people like that speaking, and then Glenn Beck was the keynote.
And they obviously were gearing up for that Texas primary, which ended in the victory of Ted Cruz.
Right.
And give me your sense. I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of where these people see themselves in the context of the Republican Party. How much awareness are they of the involvement of FreedomWorks, and how much sort of daylight is between these people and FreedomWorks?
Well, FreedomWorks, I think, prides itself on, one of the organizers told me, not being afraid to bloody up their noses, they being the Republican establishment. And that's, I think, sort of their cachet, is that they don't really care about offending mainstream Republicans. And that's been a large part of the Tea Party's success, is because it appeals to a sort of like strain of grassroots conservatism that's existed for a long time but hasn't before now had like much of a voice. I wrote a story about this that you mentioned, and one thing that I sort of got into was that as time goes on, the Tea Party, aided and abetted by groups like Freedom Works, has become a kind of counter-Republican establishment with its own bureaucracy, with its own this and that. It's less like they're not really upstarts anymore.
Right. They've become more institutionalized. Give me your sense. I'm just curious. I mean, we don't really know who funds Freedom Works, do we? I mean, we have a vague notion, but we're not really quite sure, are we?
We're not sure what? Sorry, I missed the first part.
We're not quite sure who funds Freedom Works. Do we have a sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's donors, including people like Foster Freese. His Freese Associates is a big donor of Freedom Works, as well as some other large donors and also smaller donations. They have nothing to do with the Koch brothers or anything like that.
And I'm just curious as to how the Tea Party activists perceive Freedom Works in this, because I know that, you know, I think there's still some sort of, you know, I think it's still a controversial question as to sort of which came first in some respects. I mean, the Tea Party or Freedom Works, or at least I feel like that question is controversial. What is your sense of that?
Well, I mean, there's really a question about, like, whether the Tea Party ever existed in some kind of, like, you know, pure form before these other groups came along. And books have been written about this, and it's been, you know, like, Freedom Works, for example, was trying to call for a Tea Party as long ago as, like, 2006. It didn't get any traction.
Right.
It needed, like, a spark plug, you know, a few years ago with Obamacare, like, in order for them to really get going. But I mean, I think there's like I said, there's always been this type of conservatism. It's just that I think that with the Obama administration, and especially Obamacare, it was able to like take form as a movement. But yeah, I mean, Freedom Works and those groups like that, they've been around a lot longer than the Tea Party has.
Right. I guess, you know, because I mean, I look back and I look at things like, I don't know if you know that site, angryrenter.com, which was a Freedom Works generated site. They had one, I think it was called No Bailout, No Wall Street Bailout, all of which sort of came online, you know, in the fall of 2008. And they obviously collected thousands of signatures, and you know, basically building an email list, which I think to a certain extent, you know, sort of undergirded their development in many respects. But I'm curious as to, you know, if there is an ideological difference between a self-identified Tea Party activist and Freedom Works. Did you get a sense of that at all, or?
There sort of is, actually. I mean, I would say if you had to, there's a lot of variations within the Tea Party and within that section of the right, but, you know, I'd say your average Tea Party is a party or has more of, like, a nationalist bent, and they're more sort of, you know, small government conservatives, but less focused maybe on, more focused on things like taxation than they are on, like, more big picture questions. And then Freedom Works has a much more libertarian bent. They're very interested in Austrian economics. They don't really care about national borders. So there is a slight ideological difference, but I mean, they're all in the same family.
Yeah. I'm curious. I mean, from a Wall Street bailout perspective, I mean, much of the Tea Party supposedly, I think, you know, it was Santelli's rant that supposedly, you know, started and launched the Tea Party. I mean, of course, it existed in one form, I guess, as sort of strictly as Ron Paul supporters at the time. And I wonder, you know, I mean, the thing that sort of fascinates me about it is to what extent do Tea Partiers say, hey, you know, we may be funded by the same people that ostensibly were upset by?
I don't think that among, I don't know, I don't know if that's like a big concern among them. Like, I don't think that, I think that they at this point care much more about winning elections and getting things done than they do, than they care about like how that was accomplished, or at least a lot of sort of leaders of the movement say that.
And what is the, I mean, is there a, I mean, I guess it's tough to, because obviously if people are going to a FreedomWorks rally, then the, then their suspicion of the motives of FreedomWorks would probably be, I mean, I guess there's sort of a self-selected out quality of that. But I mean, when is there, I mean, FreedomWorks is put in sort of in some type of silo where it is sort of fighting the Republican establishment. I wonder if there is any type of talk amongst the Tea Party to sort of fight the establishment of that is FreedomWorks.
Yeah, I see what you're asking. The thing is, it's hard to talk about the Tea Party as one group because it really isn't one group. It is a movement, I guess you could say, but I also think that at this point it's become kind of like a codified like ideology and a movement in the sense that like some politicians call themselves Tea Party politicians. Like, and I don't think there's a lot of dissent because it's not like a unified organized group. I don't think there's that much dissent against, groups like FreedomWorks or, you know, AFP or whoever who have turned it into a business.
And it seems like the focus that they're really focused on is basically electoral politics at this point. I mean, even in terms of their activism and the way that they're being educated, that there is somebody anoints the Tea Party or somebody picks up the mantle. I am the Tea Party candidate here, and the work that we're seeing in terms of supporting the movement is all focused through into electoral politics. Is that sort of an accurate picture?
Yeah. I mean, I think that now that they have shown that they can win elections, that's what a large part of the, I think that they train the activists how to get involved in like issue campaigns as well. But the fact that they did win so much in 2010 and that they're doing actually really well in 2012, if you look at like Ted Cruz, Richard Murdoch, I think that the focus is now winning the Senate. They don't care as much. I mean, they do care about the White House, but I mean, Mitt Romney never really endeared himself to this branch of the party. So, but they really care about making sure that Republicans are a majority in Congress.
I mean, when did you have a sense of at what point over the course of the past year that did their focus ever change? In other words, were they more invested, I guess, in the presidential race? And I'm talking both sort of emotionally and sort of financially in the presidential race during the primaries. Was there a moment over the past 6 to 8 months where they made a very sort of explicit or even less explicit decision to focus their strategy on the House and the Senate?
I think that was sort of a plan all along. I do think that there was more interest among that section of the party during the primaries when they had more options. I mean, Mitt Romney is not tailor-made to appeal to Tea Party activists. His conservatism is deemed sort of suspicious by them, and they don't think that he's really for real. Of course, like, they're going to vote for him anyway, but I do think that, you know, there was excitement among Tea Partiers around, like, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, especially Rick Perry, I think, and that sort of faded away once they all dropped out.
And was there anything that can you point to any time or anything that where it became sort of clear that FreedomWorks was sort of maybe changing their strategy, or was this FreedomWorks? They started this cycle basically. We're just going to focus on the Senate and the House races.
FreedomWorks is full of very smart people, and I think that they know what they can accomplish, and I think they know that the way to really get their pet candidates in is by focusing on these House and Senate races, especially Senate races in their case.
And what other races do you think that they've sort of targeted?
Josh Mandel in Ohio, Richard Murdoch in Indiana. Obviously, Ted Cruz was like a huge win for them.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? I'm like totally blanking. There's a few others that they focused on.
And do you have a sense that there are specific House races that they're looking into? Or are they, I imagine, obviously, those are not as high profile, at least from a national standpoint. But did you come across any organizing? I mean, did when you have these, whatever it was, 14,000 people, are they breaking down into smaller groups? Are they breaking down along the lines of like issues or regions of the country? Or how are they organizing themselves?
I mean, you know, regions of the country, whatever. The fact of the matter is, like, a lot of people care more about, like, the county commissioner race wherever they live than they care about, like, whoever the congressman is going to be or the senator. So a lot of people are taking the skills that they learn with FreedomWorks or whoever and applying them to, like, super local races.
Mm.
There's Tea Party groups. If you look at any city, there's Tea Party groups. There's a Tea Party group in Brooklyn. Like, there's... You know, like everywhere, like a little group springs up. It's a question of how much they actually do.
And was, you know, from a technology standpoint or from sort of a tactical standpoint, how will they continue to get training and support from FreedomWorks going forward?
I don't know. They keep going to things. That where FreedomWorks is offering training. And I also think that, like, you learn these skills. It's not as if they're, like, really complicated skills. It's, like, basic get-out-the-vote stuff that, like, campaigns teach volunteers. And, you know, I think, like, the ones that become really interested take on a larger role in the movement, train other people. So it's self-perpetuating.
And demographically speaking, I mean, who were these 14,000 people? I mean, are we talking young people, old people? I mean, I've got to ask just to do due diligence. White people, black people, what are...
The majority, you know, like white, middle-aged, middle class.
And... And I mean, how many of these people have become sort of professionalized? In other words, do you get a sense of how far into the ranks of these people, FreedomWorks and other organizations are sort of professionalizing these people? Are all these 14,000 people, are they going home and they're not getting any type of direct funding at all from FreedomWorks?
The thing is, like, FreedomWorks doesn't use its money in the sense of, like, paying people. It uses its money in the sense of, like, okay, so we're going to focus on this campaign and we're going to spend, like, however many thousands on signs and we're going to spend, like, this amount of money on, like, phone banks and stuff like that. So they're not actually paying activists. And they also, like, they hardly ever make payments directly to candidates' campaigns. That virtually never happens. Like, the way that they do is they spend money on doing the types of stuff that, like, campaigns do like when they're trying to do get out the vote.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at with that question is when you look at the people who are on the payroll of FreedomWorks, are they simply all based in Washington, D.C.? Are they are there regional managers? Are there regional directors? Are there local directors? I mean, do you have a sense of what their flow chart would look like? And at what point sort of unpaid activists intersect with paid activists? I mean, you know.
Well, the leadership is based in Washington, D.C. That's where their main office is. They do have field offices. I'm not sure how many. But, you know, they have, like, you can become involved with, like, you can become, like, a member. They have a membership program, and you can become a member of FreedomWorks and be involved with, like, FreedomWorks groups in your area. I think that's the way that a lot of activists get involved.
And what do you do if you want to join FreedomWorks? You got to pay dues? You get a sticker? Or what happens?
No, it's free. It's free. I think you just join up, like, on the website or whatever.
And when these people join up on the website and they decide we want to have a meetup or something like that, they're just working with people in D.C. or Is there a local, you know, a regional person for, I don't know, the Southwest of the United States that they work with? I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of just sort of how they're structured.
I think if you're near some, like, one of the, you know, if you're near somewhere where a Freedom Works representative is, you team up with that. But I don't pretend to know the specifics of how somebody gets involved.
Okay. All right, great. Well, I mean, interesting piece, and it's certainly something that I think, you know, is somewhat flying under the radar in some respects, particularly their focus on specific Senate and House races, to the exclusion in some ways of organizing around the presidential elections. And I appreciate you talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Next up, we have an interview I did with Ring of Fire. I wanted to remind you guys that Ring of Fire is now on Sunday, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern in New York City, if you listen to WWRL 1600 AM. This next interview is with Elizabeth Klein. She is the author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. So, Elizabeth, let's start from just, you know, why it was that you... What inspired you to write Overdressed? What is it? I mean, obviously, you talk about how you were a, I guess you called yourself a sort of a cheap fashion. Well, I don't know if you could use the word junkie, but it sounds like that's what you were.
Yeah, I was. But I think, you know, what set me to writing the book was the fact that I was really the typical American consumer, where buying around 68 garments and 7 pairs of shoes per year. And I was certainly doing the same thing. I had clothes. My clothes were just spilling out of my closet. They were in storage in the basement under my bed. I just had so much clothing. And I really wanted to write about how clothing went from this very personal, locally made thing that we would keep for our entire lives to essentially a disposable good, and how that's tied to low price, to clothing being cheap.
Well, so, I mean, how did it, when was this, this turn made? I mean, because, you know, we see this parallel, in some respects, in terms of food as well. You know, back in the early 70s, we essentially changed our agriculture policy and started, there was a concerted effort to make food a smaller part of the American budget, and end up coming in the form of corn subsidies, and then making all this processed food, which provided not as much nutritional value, but was far cheaper to produce and to consume. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are so many parallels between the food industry and the clothing industry. You know, just as we've seen with fast food, we buy most of our clothing now from huge corporations that are able to drive their costs down by producing clothes in huge volumes. I mean, a company like Zara, for example, which is a Spanish fast fashion company, they're producing 1 million garments per day. And the other thing that these companies are doing is they scour the world looking for the lowest wages. So right now, Bangladesh is a really popular garment-producing country, and the reason why is because it is legal to pay workers $43 a month there. So yeah, there are a lot of parallels. The fashion industry is very corporate now. It's running on unsustainable volumes, and it's trying to hook consumers into shopping more, because it seems to be that the people running these companies think that that's the only way to turn a profit now.
When did it start? I mean, do you have a sense of when and what were the forces behind sort of starting this trend?
Well, I think that the consolidation in the fashion industry, that really happened heavily in the 90s. I mean, you could trace it back many decades before that, but that's when you started to see independent department stores shuttering and being bought up. You know, now most department stores are owned by Macy's. And then you also had Gap introducing Old Navy, its lower price line in 1994. It was somewhere in the mid-90s. And I think what was interesting about Old Navy is that they used a huge marketing budget to convince American consumers that cheap was, it was chic, it was fashionable. You know, there's always been cheap clothes, but the difference is that Americans used to aspire to own the best clothing they could for their money. And suddenly what we were seeing was people bragging about owning cheap stuff. I mean, now that's a huge part of the culture. We even, you know, our First Lady wears clothes from Target, and we love her for it.
And so, I mean, what was it? I mean, was it simply sort of the that you had a, I guess a lot of these corporations just became sort of financialized in some ways, and this was the best way. This is the sort of the quickest and easiest path to providing shareholders and board of directors and CEOs with a higher compensation because they're tying it into their stock prices, and their stock prices, it's easier. You can move to this sort of high volume, low cost, I guess, recipe for increasing your profits.
Sure. I mean, that's part of it. It is part of just the way that corporations operate. They always have to grow. And one of the ways these companies are doing that is by moving into new markets. You know, H&M and Forever 21 and Zara are moving into China now. I know that Australia has seen a big explosion in fast fashion chains in the last year. So it's growth in terms of spreading these stores all over the globe. And that's a bad thing because the fashion industry is already a huge polluter. It uses a tremendous amount of resources. So it's scary to think what's going to happen when these habits spread to other parts of the world. I think that these corporations also, they benefited from a lot of trade liberalization that happened in the 90s. There used to be a lot of protections for the U.S. industry, garment and textile industry, and now those don't exist anymore. So these companies have complete and total free access to factories anywhere in the world. And as of 2005, there are virtually no restrictions on where you can source garments and textiles.
And we've seen, obviously, just a precipitous decline in textile manufacturing here. And, of course, that's a tremendous amount of loss of jobs, which is there's a sort of a, I guess, a self-perpetuating loop as you have lowered wages for workers, the demand for cheaper clothes grows. And so this sort of it's sort of almost like a perfect feedback loop.
It totally is, and I think that's, you know, consumers, we have to start thinking about that. When we buy really cheap imported goods, we're essentially choosing that over supporting, a price that could support domestic jobs. So, you know, when you do go buy that dress at Target or that dress at Old Navy, it is completely linked back to our economy and our jobs, and that's why we've seen, you know, the garment industry. We used to make 50% of our clothes here in 1990, which is not so long ago, and now we make 2% here. So
wow.
It's one of the most outsourced industries there is, and you know, it's really sad. I mean, partly because, especially in New York, the garment industry, you know, even the part that still exists, really was focused on really quality, detailed, skilled clothing, and people have just chosen these sort of disposable synthetic rags that are being sold in bulk in cheap fashion stores.
All right, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about how people dispose of their garments and what we think happens to them and what actually does, and then how we can address this. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Elizabeth Klein. All right, Elizabeth, you know, in the last segment we talked about you told me a stunning statistic that I had not really, I think, fully absorbed, that as late as 1990, 50% of our clothing was made in the United States, and now it's 2%. And the quality of that clothing obviously has diminished tremendously, and clothing itself has become something that is is just as disposable as sort of the wrapping that we get our sandwich in. What happens? I mean, just walk us through the process. We go and we buy these clothes, and I have to say that, you know, obviously I can't imagine there's anybody in our audience who isn't guilty of this in some way. And I have a 7-year-old daughter, and, you know, the option of buying something that's incredibly cheap because I know she's going to grow out of it in a couple of months is simply too alluring. But they're really that's also the way that we clothe ourselves.
Right. I mean, the book really focuses on conspicuous consumption, going out and buying clothes that you don't need. So it's not necessarily directed at people who are buying clothes for their kids. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Right.
But
I got to say, you know, the point remains. I mean, I look at this $6 shirt that I buy my child, and mm-hmm. I know I don't want to look at the label because I know, you look at that label. Well, tell us what's behind that label. When I looked at it at Bangladesh, you're telling us that there is the person making that clothing is making $43 a month. And that's probably not the most horrific of stories behind that clothing.
Well, it's not even that. It's not even so much about, about sweatshops or some headline grabbing story of misery. My point is that those are legal wages, but they are poverty wages. And they don't, they're not only, that's not a fair wage for the person that's making that clothing in Bangladesh. But the other point is that it makes it virtually impossible for our factories to compete. We can't compete with that. It's sort of like how you're saying you can't resist a deal in the store. Our factories, the people who are making our clothes can't resist $43 a month versus, maybe $9 to $11 an hour for the garment workers here. And the other thing you were bringing up was about what happens to our clothes when we're done with them. And that was another thing that I was really shocked by is that charities don't resell most of the clothes that we donate because we simply donate too much of it. So it gets sold to textile recyclers who ship it overseas. They turn it into fiber and wiping rags. But because we're buying such cheap clothes, we're also donating very low quality clothes. So the value of used clothing is also going down, which makes it much more difficult for charities and textile recyclers to make money and stay afloat.
And you make the point that shopping has become essentially a hobby in some respects because of the disposable and cheap nature of these clothes. How do we break out of this? I mean, is it possible for consumers at this point, when we have such a small margin of clothes being made in this country, to actually impact this sort of horrific cycle?
Yeah, I think that shopping has really become more of a habit than a hobby. A lot of times we're just buying clothes on impulse just because it's cheap. And I think the main thing that I took away from my research and that I talk about in the book is just being more mindful. That could mean buying fewer garments per year and caring for what you own. A lot of it is just about remembering that human beings sewed your clothes. They took resources and energy to make, and you're responsible for them. Once you buy them and once they're in your closet, you should take care of them and make sure that they get worn. A lot of times people are just buying things and throwing them in the back of their closet or wearing them once and throwing it out. The other thing I would say is, there isn't one way to be a responsible fashion consumer. Everybody has a different budget. There's so many different things you can do. You can buy secondhand if that's your thing. You can also support independent designers, even if they don't produce in the States. It's like, there's just so many different strategies, I guess, that people can take. And I actually keep a blog, thegoodcloset.tumblr.com, and it covers a lot of different alternatives, and it helps explain how people can get involved with ethical consumption of clothing.
One of the things that I notice, I tend to just,
I'm not a very big shopper myself, and I tend to bring stuff down to the tailor to fix, you know, things that are 10, 15 years old. And literally the tailor will just look at me and go, just buy a new one. And, you know, one of the things you talk about is also sort of this notion of we should learn to sew. I mean, I haven't seen a sewing machine since I was, I don't know, maybe 15. That seems like that whole element of society, or at least that sort of, you know, I guess I don't know if people, they're still home ec in school or something like that, but there doesn't seem to be any sort of mechanism to sort of teach people to take care of their clothes.
Right. You bring up a lot of really good points there that, you know, I tried to address in the book, and I think that, you know, learning how to sew for me was about becoming a better consumer. Before, I didn't really understand what a well-made garment was. What does that mean? You know, it's like, it's something that I would have, if I had grown up in my grandmother's generation, I would have understood sort of intrinsically, but I had to sort of go back and teach myself. So the reason why I learned is because I wanted to be able to walk into a store and know when I was getting my money's worth. And that's why I do encourage people who are interested in learning how to sew to do that. The other part of it is that it's if you want to, you know, sew on a button, hem your pants, take in the side seams on a shirt, sewing is obviously a great solution, as is supporting a seamstress or tailor in your community. And I think that that leads me to another point, is that, you know, when people are saying, what can I do, how can I make a difference, a lot of people own, their closets are overflowing with clothes. So another good tip is to just creatively, you know, look in your closet and creatively reimagine things that you already own. If you're not wearing something because it doesn't fit right, take it to a tailor, and hopefully your tailor won't just tell you to buy something new.
Well,
Elizabeth, it's really thinking about the whole life cycle.
Well, we're out of time, but it's a fascinating topic, and it's really something that I think people just don't spend enough time thinking about. So I really appreciate you taking the time and writing your book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Dr. David Graeber. He is a teacher at the University of London, an anthropologist and author of Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Welcome to the program, Doctor.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, I want to get to, obviously, and particularly on a day like today where there are multiple direct actions going on involving Occupy Wall Street and Occupy other cities on the West Coast, on the ports, of course, in New York City, at least 17 arrested today following a protest at Goldman Sachs and Brookfield Properties. And I want to get to your perspective on this. I think at least people on this program are well aware of your role in the early organization of Occupy Wall Street. But I've read your book. It's fascinating, and I really want to get into that to start off.
Okay.
Let's just start with the concept of debt, because I think you know, we all have a perception that we know what it is, and particularly in this country, and I think probably perhaps more so now across the globe. There, we all have this sort of specific notion of that it's a moral obligation, and then, but it's also to do with finance, and we things get conflated, and I think the most important thing about your book is to really that it attempts to unwind these strands of these sort of braided notions that come together in debt. Explain to us what is debt.
Well, the conclusion I finally came to in writing the book is that what a debt is, it's a promise. It has no greater moral standing or less moral standing than any other promise you might make. It's a very peculiar type of promise because it's been made impersonal and transferable. That is to say, well, if I promise to do something to you, you can't really pass that promise to someone else. Now, so then I asked, well, what is it that makes a debt a promise that's transferable? How is that possible? And historically, it seems to be two factors, the confluence of math and violence. On the one hand, you can exactly quantify what's required. On the other hand, you have some sort of structure in place to force people into going along with it. And debt, in the sense that we would recognize it, money in the sense that we recognize it, really is more a product of relations of violence, of war, of coercion, than it is of what we usually think of as peaceful trade.
And so, in other words, we have a situation where we all know the concept of debt as in, like, you know, or promise, you know, I promise to meet you at 5 o'clock. And that's not something that you could transfer to someone else. It has no value.
Yeah, I can't give you somebody else's promise to meet me. And the other thing is it's renegotiable. If something comes up, right, I promise to meet you at 5 o'clock, and you know, there's a general strike, the trains aren't running. Something, you know, you can always renegotiate a promise. Debts, because they become impersonal, because they get corrupted by mathematics, there you can't. Or the idea is that you really ought not to do so. And that has tremendous effects because it means that a promise that's measured in money, a debt, tends to get treated as totally different and somehow morally higher than a promise that you make to someone you love or a promise that a politician makes to the people of the country who elected them.
Now, I want to talk about that sort of the moral ascendancy of a financial debt, even over one of, you know, that people make arrangements with each other. I mean, people make promises all the time. I promise to love you for the rest of your life and to be your husband and wife, and we have divorces all the time.
And those promises are explicitly sacred. You know, they're sacred vows, except people break them.
And so now, in, you know, from an anthropological perspective, do we know which preceded? I mean, what was the impetus of this? Because, in other words, you talk about how in the book how and like you said, debt becomes sort of like the nexus of math and political violence in some way. What preceded which? In other words, was it the idea of, like, was it people who were owed stuff want to be able to enforce it, so we need to change debt into something that can be calculable?
Well, this is a really interesting question, and it's really the question of how does money come about? We were all taught this story. You know, once upon a time there was barter, and people used to sit around saying, "Tell you what, I'll give you 20 chickens for that cow." You know, eventually this becomes inconvenient. They have to invent money. In fact, as any anthropologist can tell you, this is nonsense. We've never managed to find a society anywhere in which, you know, everyday transactions took that form. And the reason is obvious. The whole barter myth is based on, you know, what an economist would call the spot trade. I give you this, you give me that, we walk away. If you're talking about the Neolithic village somewhere, these people are your neighbors, right? So, you know, if I say, I'll give you 20 chickens for that cow, I mean, even imagine this happens. And he doesn't need chickens right now. According to economists, the deal is off. In fact, you're his neighbor. You know, it's great to have your neighbor in your debt. So you'd say, no, come on, take the cow. It's on me. Don't even think about it. And now he owes you one. So you have, this is what you find. You find in ordinary societies about money, everybody has sort of debts to everybody else. And they're not exactly quantified, because there's no reason to do so. So the question is, you know, how do you get from that to the point where you can say 27 of these equals 5 of those, which is what you get money, this sort of exact measurement of debt. Now, what seems to be the case is that it happens exactly in situations where somebody is actually committed violence. Say some people get in a fight and somebody cut off. Often law codes and society, even societies about markets, will have very detailed lists of, like, you know, if somebody damages someone's eye, that's 27 heifers. If somebody damages someone's ear, that's 32, and so forth and so on. And that's exactly the kind of situation where you do want to figure out, well, first of all, people are at least willing to compromise and be generous with one another. It's like, no, I demand 32 heifers or this means war, right? And second of all, where they might not have heifers, so you have to substitute something else. So, in fact, that's where money seems to emerge, as this way of measuring debts that you owe for violence, so compensation, fines, things like that.
And so, so
it starts out.
So I'm sorry. So just I want to make this clear because, you know, we have this perception of, like, you know, this debt, this whole notion of debt society, and the people getting into debt is a somewhat recent phenomena that is destroying and it is somehow immoral. There's some type of moral connotations about creating debt.
Oh, we shouldn't be in debt. Yeah.
But in fact, debt even preceded the notion of money.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, a sense of having some kind of moral obligation, owing somebody something, now that goes way back. The idea that you can exactly figure out how much and that you can pay it off. In fact, in a lot of societies, debt is considered the essence of morality. It's only right that everybody should owe each other something. So that, for example, this is true whether in African societies, many African societies, or even in medieval England, it was considered wrong to cancel out the debts, because then you're saying, like, well, nobody really needs each other or wants to have anything to do with each other. So if somebody gives you a present, you want to give something back. You want to give something a little bit more valuable or a little bit less valuable than what they gave you. Because if you give something exactly the same, you're saying, I don't even see you anymore.
Yeah, in fact, you and then you also, in the development of money, you also discussed sort of the precedent of essentially money being a function of war, and it, in fact, that debt that continues the circulation of money, that that the king would give to the military money.
Ah, yes, it's clients. Yeah.
Explain this, that dynamic of taxes and military, and how, in some ways, the government must always be in debt for money to have any value.
Yes. Well, it's very, this is a long story, but basically, you know, first you have these credit systems. They're quantified, but they're still credit systems, so you can cancel the debts periodically, which they used to do all the time in ancient Mesopotamia and ancient Judea. Now, then coins come much later. Coins come basically to pay soldiers because, first of all, you know, soldiers are the people most likely to be carrying our little tiny bits of loot, gold and silver, that can break it up. Second, the people you'd least like to extend credit to because they're heavily armed and kind of just passing through. But kings found, okay, we'll take little bits of gold and silver, we'll stamp our picture on them, give them to the soldiers, and then say, okay, everybody in the kingdom has to give me one back again. Now, this doesn't make any sense if gold and silver just sort of naturally money. You just grab the mines, right? And kings would do that. But so why demand taxes, you know, in gold and silver? Well, it's the easiest way to basically employ your entire population feeding the soldiers, which was a big problem in antiquity. How to get, you know, if you have 50,000 people, how to get food to them. So money, cash markets that operate on coins, tend to occur around where armies are for much of human history. And they're basically part of military operations. Armies go out and get slaves. They put the slaves in the mines get, like, more gold and silver, the kings stamp it and give it to soldiers, so forth and so on. Okay, so you have that. Now, that connection between money and war is one of those sort of phenomena that runs throughout history that we never like to really talk about. So you have this story that they're supposed to be opposed. You know, this comes from the 19th century. They had this idea, well, you know, there's these old feudal kings and they were violent and they... And then we have the merchants, and the merchants are where money comes from, and they're into, you know, that's the domain of free contract and the free market, and these are opposed principles, market versus state. It's, you know, if you look at what really happened in history, no, markets tend to be created by states in order to feed armies. And this is still the case. Modern money, actually, it's paper money, but it was created, the first example of it really is 1694. Bunch of merchants in England lend money to the king to fight a war, pay his soldiers. And he says, okay, you can take that money I owe you and lend it back to other people. take the debt, basically, and lend it to people in the form of paper money, which is what British money is. It's the king's debt to the merchants circulated to other people. It actually even says on it, you know, a British bill says, I promise to pay the bearer at £10, and then has a picture of the queen. And so if the king or queen ever paid back the debt, there would be no money.
Yeah, okay, let me just stop you here for a second, because let me just stop you here, because this is, I mean, this is very dense stuff, I think, and I just want to walk people through this a little bit, because it's fascinating. And so just to be clear, the bankers would lend the king money, and the king would essentially give them IOUs, which became cash money. And the king would say to the bankers, lend this money out, and so then the people would have these little IOUs from the king.
From the king.
And this is how they would exchange it, and some people would send that back to the king, ultimately in the form of taxes.
Exactly, and that's what makes the system work, because the king can say, well, it's a debt for me, and then say, well, what do you get for it? Well, you can cancel it against your debt to the king, which is taxes.
And really, but at the end of the day, the king is sort of holding somewhat of the bag in a way, because if they were to pay off, or someone is, the bag keeps sort of moving around. But if someone was to pay it off, it would essentially pull all those notes. And so that's why, as a government, we need a certain amount of debt. Yes?
Precisely. And in fact, we ran into this a couple times in American history, under Jackson and under Clinton. This is Andrew Jackson tried to pay off the U.S. debt, the Revolutionary War debt that everybody's complaining about. Again, sort of moral, oh, we shouldn't be in debt. He got rid of it. He got rid of the central bank and, created this giant financial panic. So they had to go back to the debt again. Same thing under Clinton. He was running budget surpluses. Everybody's saying, oh, it was so virtuous. He was like gradually going to get rid of the U.S. debt. In fact, it now turns out that everybody panicked because they did projections. And they discovered that, if there was no debt, the economy would collapse. Even people like Alan Greenspan were saying, well, no, we have to have a deficit. And you couldn't admit it because, that would be a sort of lefty Keynesian interpretation that money is actually government debt and it's necessary. So he said, oh, we can't have a budget surplus because if there's too much money floating around, the government's got to use it to buy something. So they're just going to start buying up the economy and we're going to end up being communists.
Right.
That was his law. But in fact, what he was thinking is, no, if there's no government debt, there's no money. That's what money is. Money is circulating government debt.
And so what of the fears that people talk about? What do you make of the fears that people talk about that we have too much debt as a government, that we must the number one crisis we have is the deficit, that the idea of borrowing, of the government being this far in debt, is slowing down the economy and it's extracted this money from the private markets?
Right, that's the line. And, it is true that if, there's government debt circulating around, it means the banks don't have to produce all the money themselves. That's the other great secret in every system. Banks make money. They are granted this monopoly in making up money. Now, the problem with this is, first of all, it's backwards. If there was, no deficit at all, it would be much greater disaster than too much deficit. If you have too much deficit, it can create too much money floating around, and that could create inflation. If last I checked, the inflation rate in the U.S. was not a problem. The reason for that, in turn, is because the inflation only just really starts kicking in when you have full employment. And our big problem is that we have huge unemployment. So it's just insane from any sort of classical economic terms. Now, of course, people in power can buy economists and create economic schools, which will say that whatever they want to do is right. And that's what's going on here. But serious economists see them. Don't think this is nonsense. The idea that the debt is our big problem in a place time when we have nearly 10% unemployment is just insane. What's going on, I think, is, again, the moral card. You can always... Debt and morality are seen as the same thing. You can always appeal to people's sense that there's something terribly morally wrong by saying, oh, the government's spendthrift, we're in debt, this is going to affect our children. It has nothing to do with the way the economy actually works.
Now, let's talk about this idea, which I also found fascinating in your book, that and because I have many arguments with economic libertarians about this, the idea that the government is interfering in the market, and what we want is fully free market as possible, envisioning this you know, getting back to that market that exists in nature before a government comes and corrupts it. But in fact, that never existed, did it?
Absolutely not. I mean, markets, the way they think of them anyway, have been historically created by governments, usually as a side effect of military operations. And occasionally you do get periods of history in which markets sort of float free of governments to a certain degree. But even there, it's under very unusual circumstances, and the markets start looking extremely different than the kind that the libertarians are thinking about. The greatest example that I give in the book, and this is one of the great ironies of history, actually, is medieval Islam, the caliphate. Under the caliphate, they did have a free market ideology, and to some degree, they created a free market, which went way beyond the domains of any kingdom. But yeah, they did it through Sharia. They did it by creating civil courts, having the government really have nothing to do with regulating economic affairs, so that, and also by eliminating usury. So those courts banned any taking of interest at all. And arguably,
when you do that, you're really just creating a different government. I mean, you're creating a theocratic structure that is just as impinging upon the market as would a government from that perspective.
You could take that argument. I mean, the difference between those courts and government courts is they couldn't put you in jail. They couldn't actually, punish you other than by destroying your credit rating. However, in a place where, you know, there was no enforcement other than the courts of contracts, your reputation was everything. So you couldn't do business unless you had a reputation of being an honorable person who paid his debts, insofar as it was reasonable. However, you know, the result of the fact that there was nobody to put you in jail meant that the very idea of economics starts looking very, very different. It becomes a matter of personal honor and trust and reputation rather than so profit gouging, the sort of extremely competitive view of what an economy is about sort of also went away because, as I always put it, you can't have cutthroat competition when there's nobody stopping you from actually cutting each other's throats.
Right. So that notion of we're going to protect your factory, we're going to sit here. I mean, almost as if, you know, what we're seeing in the ports on the west coast of this country right now. That situation, you wouldn't have an army, literally, of police in riot gear with clubs and so-called non-lethal
precisely
weapons.
And that in turn affects the way that you can treat your workers.
Now, all right, so let's move. This is all fascinating stuff, and the implications of all of this, of course, is that, I mean, how did we get to the point where all of these things, because we're told, I mean, you also put to light not only this notion of the market existing separate from the state, but also the sort of the barter and the Adam Smith sort of mythology. You put all this to rest. And at the end of the book, and before we get there, will you also just tell us about the Wizard of Oz? Because I had never heard this before, and it was fascinating. And I can't wait to sit down with my daughter and watch the movie again. But tell us about the Wizard of Oz as a metaphor, and to the extent that it was actually meant in this fashion.
Well, nobody's been able to prove it conclusively, but it's so suggestive. And it seems that even by the time they put on the play of Wizard of Oz, which was in 1901, you know, a year after the book came out, people thought that this was what it was about. Essentially, at that time, one of the big political struggles was over the nature of money, whether they had a gold standard at that point. And a lot of it was causing a sort of tight money policies, which was causing debt crises to affect farmers who had been foreclosed on. And the farmers were trying to run a populist candidate to make what they called bimetallism. Let's create a silver standard because there's a lot of silver mines cropping up at the time. It would make for a cheaper money policies. So there are all these debates about monetary policy. And the book appears to be a giant metaphor for the William Jennings Bryan Populous Silver campaign. Because, you know, what do you get? You get this woman, Dorothy, whose name is suspiciously similar to Theodore Roosevelt, Dorothy Theodore, who is a part of this farm family that gets swept away by a tornado. She gets translated, you know, transported to the land of Oz, O-Z, which is, of course, the word for ounce. She's on the Yellow Brick Road, which is like gold bars, right, toward the Emerald City, which is green. And the only way out is, they change it to ruby slippers in the movie, but it's silver slippers is her only escape. And along the way, she meets a scarecrow, and the scarecrow actually represents the farmers who have no brains because they're always getting these bad debt contracts and getting foreclosed on. Then she meets the Tin Woodsman, who's like the industrial proletariat who has no heart because he won't act in solidarity with the farmers because they kept trying to get the Northeast proletariat to vote for the populist candidate. Then he meets the Cowardly Lion, who are the political class who have no courage because they can't face up to the East Coast and West Coast bankers, who are in fact the Wicked Witch of the East and the West. And you get the idea, so forth and so on. The entire thing is this gigantic monetary allegory.
And what is it that what we learn when the Wizard of Oz is exposed?
Pardon me?
What do we learn when the Wizard of Oz is exposed at that point?
Ah, that the whole money system is flimflam. It's all smoke and mirrors. It's all created by, you know, these sort of phony elites. And the Federal Reserve didn't exist at that time. But, you know, the local equivalents, it's all kind of a scam where they just make up money and you believe it.
But in fact, and you talk about this, money has gone sort of back and forth from being that. And maybe it's always that, no matter between the difference between being virtual credit money and commodity money. Explain the difference between that. And if there really is any meaningful difference in terms of, you know, the intrinsic value of money.
Well, this is actually one of the great discoveries, I think, of my book. And it's to some degree inspired by an anthropologist named Keith Hart, who wrote a book called Two Sides of the Coin. What he argued is that money is always two things. It's always both a thing, a commodity, and it's also promise, a social relationship. And economists, you know, there's no consensus among economists which one is primary, which one money really is. It's one of the ironies of economics that even though what economists do is they describe a world made possible by money, they don't actually know what money is. There's no consensus. But what I found is that it kind of veers back and forth over the course of history. So in ancient Mesopotamia, basically you have credit money. You don't, coinage is invented much later. So people, in fact, they didn't even make scales accurate enough to measure out the tiny pieces of silver that would have been required to buy like a hammer or, you know, a pair of pants or some chicken or something like that. So all everyday transactions were on credit. They had these very complicated credit systems with compounded interest rates long before the existence of coins. Now, then starting around 600 in China, India, and the Aegean, Eastern Mediterranean, pretty much simultaneously, close to that, people invent coins, which seems to be a military thing. It's paying soldiers, as I was saying. And then it shifts back again. In the Middle Ages, the empires collapse. The coins go away, and you go back to credit systems. That's when they're writing checks. Checks is an Arabic word, actually, in Middle East. You know, you have these credit systems that turn to paper money in China. People using tally sticks in Europe. So you have virtual money again. Slavery largely disappears. The big empires crumble.
That virtual money uses the units that were developed by the physical money just because that's the tradition, yes?
Exactly. And Europe is a really fascinating example of that because everybody says, well, ages people reverted to barter. Nonsense. Again, nobody was saying, I'll give you 20 chickens for that cow. What they were doing was they were using money that didn't physically exist. So everybody was using Roman currency, even though there wasn't any Roman currency actually around. But they're figuring it out. They're making transactions. They're renting things. They're lending things. They're calculating interest, even though that became technically illegal. So they were using and they did the same thing. Under Charlemagne, he issued money, and that money just almost completely disappeared immediately. Charlemagne didn't last very long. However, for like another 600 years, that's what people use. That's where pound, shilling, and pence come from. They're Carolingian money. But people actually called it imaginary money. Local kings would create their own currency sometimes, although they were used for very limited purposes. Mostly people were using credit. But all the credits and debts were calculated in this money that no longer exists.
Is that the sort of the, would that be the functional equivalent of when people describe, you know, fiat money today, when they say, like, you know, all the Fed is doing is just creating fiat money and it's not backed? I mean, isn't that essentially the same thing, or is that even?
It's credit money. You see, that's what fiat money really is. It's a credit system. Money is IOUs. Because, you know, the idea of fiat money implies that money should be a commodity, that gold really is money somehow, and that, you know, modern governments are just like taking this stuff and saying, I demand you treat it as gold or I'll shoot you, basically. That goes back to that whole idea that you have governments, you have markets, they're really separate and governments interfere. Now, what's really happening is that if money is credit, you need somebody to regulate the system. And in fact, that happens throughout history. This is the really fascinating thing. Okay, so you have the credit systems in Mesopotamia, then you have cash for about 1,000 years, then it disappears in the Middle Ages, and then, of course, cash comes back after 1492. You have this huge influx of gold and silver. People have this idea, we shouldn't be in debt to each other. We should really use coins in everyday transactions. You know, it seems almost moral to suddenly not to be in debt, like we feel now. That's the thing, that period that ends in 1971, when Nixon goes off the gold standard. So we start entering back into a period of virtual money, which is really credit money. Money's a promise. It's an IOU. And people are still thinking in these antiquated terms. They say, no, it's fiat money that's created by the government. It's not real money. And the idea that real money is a thing. But in fact, the original form of money was virtual money. It's not any more real than anything else. But you need some kind of mechanism to make sure it doesn't go crazy. That's true. And that's the difference. And we haven't figured out how to do that yet.
And you say that once we moved into that sort of once we move into periods of virtual credit money, that generally there are protections for debtors. Because otherwise, too much money would be lent out. People would get too far in debt. They would be default, and then they end up having literally to sell themselves off as slaves. And you go on to say that the ancient Greeks would probably perceive Americans today in some ways to be slaves, and that they have reached that point where they're constantly catching up. But how is it? What has gone so wrong in our economies in this country? And when we look at Europe, the IMF has said, you know, the people who have been lending this money, essentially the other day, they're not going to have to take a haircut on these. They're not going to have to suffer at all in the course of sort of this huge bailout. They're not going to have to take a haircut. We've seen in this country that bankruptcy has become less and less of an option from a legislative perspective for your average citizen. It's not an option at all if you're talking about student debt. What has gone so wrong?
Well, my analysis in the book is that we're entering in this new phase of what money is, a new phase of monetary history, but we're doing it backwards. In periods where you have virtual money, well, money is a credit. It's an IOU. It's recognized to be just a promise. Now, the problem, obviously, is what's to stop you from generating the stuff infinitely, you know, control how many promises you make, and even more importantly, what's to stop people from falling into debt traps, whereby the bulk of the population is effectively enslaved to 1 or 2%, the rich. Now, this is the great social nightmare of antiquity. Like, people fall so into debt, they'll have to sell their children, they'll have to sell off everything they have, eventually they themselves will be sold off as slaves, working for other people. Now, in a way, that's exactly what's happening right now. As you say, you know, if Aristotle were here today, you know, he would find the distinction between someone so deep in debt that he's selling himself to work for somebody else, and someone so deep in debt that he's renting himself to work for somebody else, is kind of a legalistic distinction at best. But the reason why this is happening, it seems to me, is because in every other period of virtual money, they immediately created some huge institution, often even larger than the government, to protect debtors, some great moral authority. So that was like the Jubilee system in ancient Judea. In Mesopotamia, they had these divine kings who would just get this slate clean, so get all debts are canceled. In fact, the first word for freedom known in any human language is word for debt cancellation. Everybody's off the hook. Start over, reset. Now, in the Middle Ages, they usually took a different approach. They said, okay, debt peonage is illegal and lending money at interest is illegal. And that was enforced, not again, not so much by states, but by religious institutions, church law, Sharia law, whatever it might have been. Now, in every case, though, there was some kind of protection for debtors to make sure this whole thing didn't go crazy and everybody didn't end up getting, becoming enslaved.
So it was either on the front end or the back end. Either we limit the amount that people can borrow or can be charged in terms of interest, or we have this sort of like release valve that is institutionalized.
Precisely. Presumably there's other things we could think of if we started really putting our minds to it. But there has to be something. Now, what do we do this time around? 1971, Nixon goes off the gold standard. Money becomes this free-floating credit instrument. Quickly, you see plastic emerge. Everybody's doing credit transactions. You see this credit economy where instead of the sort of social welfare state that existed in the 50s and 60s, and everybody's supposed to borrow money, get mortgages, 401ks, microcredit will save the world's poor. So credit's everywhere. You have the financialization of capital, which used to be that investment money was mostly actually producing or exchanging things. Now it's all speculation on money itself. And the vast majority of money in the world isn't related to anything anybody's actually doing. It's a speculation on other money. Okay, so you have all of this happen at once. But what do they do? Instead of creating something to protect debtors, they create the IMF, which is basically there as an international enforcement mechanism to say no one should ever default. And that sort of sets the moral standard. And as you say, they're working on the bankruptcy laws to make that much more difficult. They eliminated usury laws entirely. It used to be there was some limit on what you could lend. Now there's basically no limit. So you have these payday loan people who are charging the equivalent of 400% a year. You have to have gone to the mafia to get for most periods of history. So essentially, they create these institutions. The SNL does the same thing. You know, there are these huge overarching institutions, just like they used to have, but they're doing it completely backwards. They're protecting creditors against debtors. And the result is a social crisis across the world. It's totally non-viable. And the proof of that is that we've been in one form of debt crisis or another pretty much since 1975 or 78, I would say. So the crisis of the 70s has never really gone away. First, we shoved it off on the third world, and then they managed to squeeze out, and it's coming back on us.
And in fact, the bailing out of the banks and in the mechanism which they did it. I mean, at the end of the day, if you bought up all those mortgages and basically just said everybody's on par, I'm paying off your principal, and that money filtered back up through the banks, it probably would have had not only the same effect in terms of maintaining the solvency of the banks, it would have probably made it far more stable. But instead,
it was far more stable because people would have money to spend and the economy would have been moving along. The government could collect taxes on that money and we would have had a lower deficit. It would have been salutary on every level.
But instead, they basically again went to the lender to protect the creditor as opposed to the debtor.
Exactly. And that's just sheer political power. But it's made possible by this crazy moral discourse. And that's why I wrote the book. It's that insidious moral power of, well, you have to pay your debts. I mean, it just seems, how could you possibly suggest that people, you know, borrow money and you just let them off the hook? That's immoral. You know what? That would encourage immoral behavior. Now, of course, the irony is in 2007, 2008, what we discovered was everybody doesn't have to pay their debts at all, only the little guys. You know, money is, in fact, a promise. It's an IOU. And like any other promise, it can be renegotiated if circumstances change, if you're rich and powerful. And that has been the case throughout world history. I always say rich people can be incredibly generous, understanding, and forgiving when dealing with each other. It's just when you owe them money that suddenly debt becomes a sacred obligation.
And that leads us to the actions we have seen all across the world over this past year and the ones that we're seeing today. On the West Coast. And, you know, you've been with us for a long time, and I don't want to hold you too much longer, and I appreciate it. But I just very early on, it's been reported that when the early meetings were happening shortly after Adbusters announced the occupation in August, you were down in New York, and you were attending,
yep.
and in some ways instigating the very first General Assemblies. How?
Yeah.
I mean, that seems fairly accurate. I mean, that's been reported by Bloomberg at least. We'll link to that on majority.fm. But I'm curious as to the evolution of this, how it's gone since that time that you were engaging in those organizing activities.
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, it was a very interesting convergence of people involved in the anti-cuts movement here in New York, which was kind of a top-heavy with these, what we call vertical organizations, sort of people who put together ANSWER, to them. My role was actually, I was really just in the right place at the right time. Me and a couple of my friends sort of went to one of these meetings, which was sort of run as a rally and a march, and there's a leadership structure. But it was announced as a General Assembly. I think these guys had basically snookered adbusters who didn't really know who they were. And, you know, we kind of came in and turned it into a real democratic meeting. And that was the start of everything. We got this idea that counterposing what we have in America is utter corruption, like dressed up as democracy. And what real democracy would be like. So, you know, that was the idea. The thing is, you know, New York is a really rough place to organize. There's 40,000 police here, I think, maybe 39. People say that, like, if New York City were an independent country, we would have one of the largest armies in the world, just in the cops. So it's really rough. And I was really worried at the time, mainly that these guys would just get clobbered instantly and no one would ever know. I mean, they're always really wonderful young people, very energetic. They didn't really have a lot of experience because they're only doing it for a few years. But to be perfectly honest, the idea that this was going to spread instantly across the country and the world, I mean, obviously always dream, but like it wasn't we didn't really expect it. So the first thing that happened, you know, was we seem to have seized a moment whereby everybody's waiting for something to happen. And that moment of defiance, of we're not even going to make demands of you because you're inherently illegitimate, the idea of seizing public space because we are the public, after all, it's our space, we don't have to ask permission, that defiant tone was exactly what I think people were looking for. And that's why it just spread instantly to pretty much every community across the United States. So that was very exciting. Now, of course, the government struck back in this way, which reveals what it really is. And that's what Gandhian strategies work. This is extremely explicitly nonviolent. We weren't even doing property destruction, which is important to bear in mind because, you know, people organized this were anarchists. It's not like anarchists are people who just always break things. And the idea is to demonstrate to people, like, if you challenge authority, it doesn't matter how nice you are, it doesn't matter how nonviolent you are, they will respond with violence because violence is essentially what they are. They are enforcing a regime that can only be enforced through continual violence. And you can just provide a handy illustration of that, and that's what we've just seen. So I think, you know, the moment we're at is a moment of challenging Americans to think about what kind of country they really are.
All right. Well, David Graeber, thank you so much for joining us. Author of Debt, The First 5,000 Years, anthropologist teaching at the University of London. Thanks again for taking the time with us. I really appreciate it. Just a fascinating book. And looking forward to reading it a second time.
All right. Well, that's a wonderful compliment. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. We are back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio, streaming at airamericaradio.com, blogging at majorityreportradio.com. My name is Sam Cedar. Janine Garofalo out of town, doing the West Wing. She'll be on it Sunday night, and we'll talk to her by phone next week. In studio, it is my pleasure to welcome the Cowboy Junkies, Michael Timmons and Margo Timmons.
Hi.
Thank you for joining me.
Hi, good to be here.
That was a cut off your latest album, if you guys didn't recognize it.
it's been a while.
I Don't Want to Be a Soldier, written by John Lennon, off the new album, Early 21st Century Blues, which I'm sure is available everywhere.
Worldwide.
Fine CDs or MP3s are sold.
Exactly.
And the website is cowboyjunkies.com. And so you guys have just come off of a tour. Is it, are you just wrapping it up?
Well, we were doing some shows this summer. Like, what, 30 shows? Nothing too extensive, just sort of did some stuff.
And we talked when you first came in. This is a great way to promote it.
Exactly.
After the fact.
Retro promo, we're calling it. We're trying to start it up.
Yeah, well, a lot of our audience actually can travel temporally and spatially. That's actually, it's going to be, wait till you see how much your receipts are actually going to grow from that tour after the fact. But you've got this new album out. It is... There's a lot of covers on it, and I'm like, I'll just talk just briefly about what this album's about for you guys.
The record sort of came about. We were sort of thinking of a quick project to do. We're off the road and in between albums, and we often put together little small projects. And we began to think about what we'd experienced over the last couple of years on the road, throughout traveling in Europe and through Canada and through the States, and a lot of the political discussion and sort of the energy of people everywhere was one of concern, distraction, and I guess confusion. And so we had a few songs sitting around that were already in our repertoire that we hadn't recorded, and a couple of covers we were doing. We realized that they were all aiming towards this theme that we were experiencing through conversations with other people, sort of about the war and about violence and about greed. And so we decided to sort of go through our basics, through our record collections and our own experience with songs over the years, and pull out a few more cover versions of other people who had written on those themes and put together an album which related to that. So.
All right. Well, let's talk more about that, but let's play one.
Sure.
I mean, not us, you guys.
This is a song off the new record.
It's December Skies?
Yeah, it's December Skies.
September skies, bodies falling, never again will you catch me admiring those vast September skies. October skies heat is flying, crimson leaves slowly falling from azure October skies.
are back on the Majority Report Air America Radio, streaming at airamericaradio.com, blogging at majorityreportradio.com. My name's Sam Cedar, Janine Garofalo out of town. In studio, Michael Timmons and Margot Timmons of the Cowboy Junkies. I want to apologize for having to cut out of that beautiful song.
Commercials rule.
Commercials rule, and apparently I can't add. So I couldn't figure out how much time we needed. And actually, let me just blame Justin. Good job, Justin. But I hope it did get people to continue to listen during the commercial break and tune in now to see if you were still actually playing.
We finished about 30 seconds ago.
Yeah, it just wrapped it up. The timing was just horrible. So I want to talk just a little bit more about the album, because you guys are Canadians, and well, Canadians always have a different perspective on America than Americans do, usually a more clear-headed one, because you don't have the same necessarily ego investment that a lot of Americans do.
Well, I think it's just a matter of having a distance. You know, there's a perspective. We're outside of the literal and the figurative borders of the United States. So we have there's more European influence that comes into our country, and there's a different news media. We get tons of yours as well. So we're very close to you on that sense. But at the same time, we have this other little sort of wave that I guess adjusts our perspective. It's not necessarily the right one. It's just a different one, and it's. I think we do. I think, I mean, anybody who goes up to Canada from the States will notice there's a lot similar, but there's also a lot very different as well, and especially in these days, for sure, in the last few years.
And so what is it, I mean, tell me, what is it about these songs that you know, you guys, you had mentioned that you went through your album collection and just pulled out songs that spoke to you in terms of the reaction you had mm-hmm. from traveling around about, I guess, the Iraq invasion and I guess America's new, more militaristic stance, I guess.
Not that partly, but also, I mean, not just that one aspect of it, but even, you know, coming the other way, the whole militancy of the Middle East towards America as well, towards Western culture, the militancy then of Western culture back towards the Islamic culture, and just the sense of everything seems now to the first decision is violence, whatever side you're on or whatever, wherever you live, the solution is violence, or the supposed solution. So these songs really address all aspects of that, of greed and of violence, of war, of loss, of you know, just those sort of things which. Those very human reactions that songwriters have been addressing for years. There's a lot of traditional songs a couple of traditional songs on this record. There's songs from the 60s and from the 70s from that period of protest, and there's some contemporary ones as well.
Now, Margot, when you sing these songs, do you have a different relationship to them than you would songs that you guys would normally do?
Not really. For me, you know, I'm a singer, not a songwriter. So, you know, whether Mike's written them or whether Bruce Springsteen, it doesn't really matter to me. And really, even this album, yes, had a stronger theme. The theme came first. Usually our albums, we write them, and then as we're talking about them in the press, we sort of figure out what the theme is, you know. So this one, yes, the theme came first. But each song I just approached individually. Some of them I thought of on more of a global scale of war. Some of them, like this next one by Bruce Springsteen, to me was just something, whether you've experienced war or not, most people have experienced in their lives a moment of loss of somebody that was there yesterday and is no longer there, whether it's a husband or grandmother or somebody. And so that's how, so this one to me wasn't about war, you know, so each one is... It's different, and again, I think that's what this album, although we had the theme, I think you could listen to it regardless of your political beliefs about the Iraq War and still find stuff in it. We're all human, and none of us want to see violence done to other human beings. I mean, no matter what you believe, this is not something you want. So I think you can look at these songs and still find something in it that you can relate to.
All right. Well, let's start in with the song. I'm sorry. What song is it? It's
You're Missing by Bruce Springsteen.
All right. We're going to do this one. We're going to do the whole song.
It's 20 minutes long.
I love it. Do not hit that button, Justin. All right. And then we'll talk afterwards about the video that you guys did with Janine.
That's right.
It's scandalous.
You have to dig that one up.
Scandalous. All right. Let's hear the song.
Shirts in the closet, shoes in the hall, mama's in the kitchen, baby and all. Everything is everything. Everything is everything. But you're missing. Coffee cups on the counter, jackets on the chair, papers on the doorstep. You're not there. Everything is everything. Everything is everything. But you're missing. Pictures on the nightstand, TV's on in the den. Your house is waiting. Your house is waiting for you to walk in. For you to walk in. But you're missing. You're missing. You're missing. When I shut out the lights, you're missing. When I close my eyes, you're missing. When I see the sunrise, you're missing. Children are asking if it's all right. Will you be in our arms tonight? Morning is morning, evening falls our hair. Too much room in my bed. Too many phone calls. How's everything? Everything. 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 You're missing. You're missing. You're missing. You're missing. God's drifting in heaven. Devil's in the mailbox. I've got dust on my shoes. Nothing but teardrops.
Oh,
that's nice. Thank you.
They're under the desk. That was that's beautiful. That's Michael Timmons and Margot Timmons, Cowboy Junkies. Now you got before you go, and I should say, you're doing a show in February in Toronto. Well, it's months off.
Yeah, I told you we're on tour.
It's just bizarre. I'm looking at this going, wow, they really.
I told you we're retro-proming. Just
yes. Well, get for God's sakes, folks, get online and demand that those tickets go on sale. You'll be in Toronto in February, and then in Texas in February, and then a year from now you'll be in Kirkland.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't even know Kirkland. Where is Kirkland?
Near Seattle, apparently.
All right. Well, there you go, Kirkland.
It's a long walk.
Start to gear up. All right. Wait. So I want to hear the story before you go.
Okay.
I want to hear the story. What happened with when did you guys do a video with Janine? This is back.
Yeah, late 90s. She was in a movie, The Truth About Cats and Dogs.
With, yes, I've heard of that.
Remember that one with
yes,
Uma?
Uma Thurman.
And we had a song in it, and that song was then became our next single of a record that we were retro-promoting at the time. And so they decided to do a video, which we fought against, but they decided to do it, and Janine was kind enough to appear in the video. The original idea was they were going to tie it in with the film, but nobody from the film wanted to tie it in, and everybody's ashamed of the film or something and whatever. So, but Janine just showed up anyways and did the video. And, it was one of the, I think it was probably our worst video. Not her fault. It was just such a
she played
lame
a
concept.
Ticket taker
so lame.
A box. So actually it was good because she was sort of
she
a
sat
sad
in box,
ticket taker.
Yeah, sad ticket taker. And we sat in the corner and did sad song. And it was such a bad, and I think it was our most expensive.
Oh
and,
yeah.
And
it's huge.
Lamest
it's a huge
video.
Shoot. All these people running around. The only people that weren't involved or interested were the people that were actually
yeah, us and
in Janine. The video.
So we sat on our respective ends of our trailer and talked every now and then and sort of bowed our head in shame when we passed by. I'm sorry, we're sorry. I think she was like, what the hell am I doing here? I got to fire my manager. But it was very kind of her to do it. But we apologize.
Did you guys, were you guys sort of anti-video? Because videos were coming up. Right around the time.
Terrible.
I mean, because I was thinking about that today. That one of like the anthems I remember listening to was the Replacements' senior video.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
That was, and it just occurred to me today, like boy, things have gotten so much worse.
Yes, mm-hmm. You're right.
Than the fact that videos exist.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It was the beginning of the end, I think, for major record companies when they started to invest all that money in videos and put all their money into them. And it was we hated them. You know,
what was it about videos that you guys hated? I mean,
well, they had nothing to do with what we did. You know, right. I mean, it was irrelevant to what we did. We're musicians. We liked making records, make music, and go out on tour. And the videos usually cost three or four times the amount our records cost. One stupid video. They never got played. Yet, for some reason, they were always a key part of the marketing plan for the record company. Even though we'd say, well. Did you
and
get
they were
played?
Really boring.
No. They're boring.
I mean,
to
you know,
make
it's not like we were going to dance or wear sexy outfits or anything. So right. You know, it was just us playing.
I mean, we didn't want any creative input into them because the minute you got creative with them, they said, "Well, no, we have to show the band like 75% of the time, so we can't do that." You know, they're just horrible, horrible.
The only the best part of videos was they always insisted on bringing wardrobe people. We said, forget it because at least we can cut that out of the budget because we're not going to wear what they're going to bring.
Right.
Always did. And it was fun because they'd bring
these
clothes and we spend the days and the boys would be in these fluffy shirts and I don't know, these sequin outfits.
And then
we'd go
out
and get our jeans or, you know, my flower dress or whatever, and do the video and the wardrobe person
even
was
makeup
always
person,
depressed.
Even the makeup person, they bring makeup people. Go away.
Oh,
I'm just going to be like my head down the whole time anyway. Yeah. So what? You know, they were just a waste of time. They're horrible. And the frustrating thing was they were so expensive. And they're our money, you know. I mean, it was the record company spending our money.
Right. That money otherwise would have because on your...
It's on our bill, you know.
And are you guys still with a major label? Or do you
We've been independent for about 6 or 7 years now. So we do our own we do our own records and we license them. Right now we license through Rounder in the United States. So it's nice. It's just you just do music and... Do retro proming, and you then you.
Right, of course, I like that retro promo. It's excellent. Well, we've been able to retro promo your summer tour, and I understand it was fantastic.
It was great. If you missed it,
and if you missed it, really blew it. And so next time, think ahead a little bit, folks.
Don't think right. Behind.
Well, exactly. Thank you so much for joining us. You got a website, cowboyjunkies.com.
Yeah, and you can get. The new record there and everywhere else, but get it there. It's better for us if you get it there.
Yeah, so folks, slam that website right now. All right, Michael and Margo, thank you so much for joining us, Cowboy Junkies. We'll be right back on the Majority Report.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice was made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost.